everyone. Welcome to the reading of the Ford Dodge Messenger for Monday, April 19th. I'm Kevin Rogers at the microphone. A gloriously sunny day in Ford Dodge. At least it was more sunny than cloudy today. But not very warm, and it looks like we've got some cooler temperatures coming our way for a couple of days. So we'll have to endure that, and then hopefully by the end of the week, things will be warming up just a little bit. In the meantime, let's go ahead and take a look at today's messenger. We'll take a more detailed look at the forecast as we conclude our time together. Helping Hands, Friends Finishing Home Project After Fort Dodge Man's Passing is the title of the first article. Dozens of friends with tools and equipment were at Dave Kaiser's Fort Dodge home on Saturday, putting siding on the garage and cleaning the property. Only he wasn't there. The Fort Dodge man, who helped many through his work with Alcoholics Anonymous, passed away on March 20th at the age of 61. Kaiser had always intended on finishing the work at his home, but he never got the chance. Dave was generous and a friend to anybody, said Steve Peterson of Fort Dodge, a friend of Kaiser's for more than 25 years. He never took the time to finish his own garage. He was too busy helping everyone else. This is one last payback. Castor Construction and CEC Electric were two local firms at the house on Saturday, offering their help. These people are just doing it out of the kindness of their hearts, said Carol Lindner, Kaiser's sister. He wanted it done before he died. He wanted the house finished. He had surgery after surgery, and it didn't get done. Kathy Otten, another of Kaiser's sisters, said her brother wouldn't have asked for the help. He would have never been able to do it, Otten said, but he never would have asked for help either. He was too proud. The workers planned to finish the job on Saturday. Some inside remodeling will be done at a later time. Linder just couldn't believe the amount of community support. After he's gone, they're still his friends, she said. He has two kids that are hoping to stay here. I think it's amazing what they're doing, and I don't know how we'd ever thank everybody. The house is apparently modeled after Life as a House, which was Kaiser's favorite movie. Kaiser's son, David Jr., said he appreciated everyone's support. Seeing all these people here just to help my dad really inspires me, he said. He touched a lot of people's lives. They aren't getting paid a dime. I know he's looking down, seeing this, and he's proud. Kaylin Christie of Lehigh, the girlfriend of another of Kaiser's sons, Seth, said the experience left her speechless. It's very emotional to see everyone coming together, she said. Dave was very loved. It leaves me speechless. He would have been very, really proud of the boys today, too. The Iowa DNR penalizes the Fort Dodge Salvage Yard, records 10 years of violations. A Fort Dodge salvage yard is in hot water with the Iowa Department of Natural Resources after 10 years of violations were recorded by the agency. Frank's Auto and Truck Salvage, LLC, at 3304 Gypsum Hollow Road, received an administrative consent order in March from the DNR due to several solid waste and stormwater violations that have occurred on its property. Multiple calls to Frank's Auto and Truck Salvage owner Dennis Frank were not returned. According to the order from the DNR, the violations date back to March 2011, when, quote, mishandled appliances were noted during a routine DNR solid waste inspection, end quote, on the property. In April 2012, there was another violation for failure to conduct the required stormwater sampling, annual stormwater inspections, and annual stormwater pollution plan training. The DNR sent a letter of noncompliance to Franks in June 2015 for conducting handled appliances during a routine solid waste inspection. Frank's appliance demanufacturing permit was rescinded in August 2018, and in September 2018, the salvage yard was warned to not demanufacture appliances until an ADP permit was reissued. A year later, in July 2019, a site visit from the DNR field office staff found that the facility was continuing to operate the salvage yard without a stormwater permit. Field office staff visited Frank's again in June 2020 and found the salvage yard was still demanufacturing appliances, and, quote, hundreds of mishandled appliances and stormwater violations were noted. DNR field office staff visited Frank's again in September 2020, and as of October 30, 2020, the facility did not have still a demanufacturing permit or stormwater permit. The Iowa Environmental Protection Commission requires a person to obtain an appliance demanufacturing permit from the DNR before conducting any demanufacturing activities. According to the DNR Administrative Consent Order, Frank's Auto and Truck Salvage has 30 days to submit an application for a stormwater permit and for an application or an appliance demanufacturing permit, and the business cannot operate, accept, or process any appliances until permits are obtained. The business was given 10 days to post signs on the property notifying the public that appliances cannot be dropped off at the facility. Frank's must also pay a $6,625 administrative penalty within 30 days. A consent order is issued as an alternative to issuing an administrative order, enforceable agreement with the other party. Looking at from our files, there's a picture of the members of the Patriot Guard standing at attention with flags outside the Ogden High School gym during funeral services for Sergeant Daniel L. Sesker of the Iowa National Guard. The Patriot Riders attend military funerals to show their support for the family. Sesker died April 6, 2005, when an improvised explosive device blew up next to the military vehicle he was in near Baijay in Iraq. He had studied at Iowa Central Community College, served as a part-time police officer in Gallery, and worked as a counselor at the Woodward Academy. Dairy life lives on without cows. Kossuth County couple maintains barn's originality. That is the title of the next article. From Ledyard, Herman and Augusta Richter bought their farm in 1912 or 1914. It's where their grandson Russ Richter and their granddaughter Deanna Richter live today. A sign designating the Richter farm as a century farm is located on their driveway. Herman and Augusta Richter were parents of eight children, one of whom was Fred, Russ and Deanna's father. Fred's farm, where they grew up, was a mile and a half away from their grandparents, just across the field, said Deanna. It was grandfather Herman who built the farm for horses and dairy cattle, along with a one-room house where Russ and Deanna Richter live today. The house has been enlarged while the barn retains much of its originality. Uncles Harold and Herman Richter took over the farm from their parents, Herman and Augusta. Russ Richter continued the farm when his uncles quit in 1970. The barn was always used for dairying, milking 28 cows until 2000. Russ returned to milking after being out of it for a year and later gave it up. The barn received improvements under Russ's ownership, getting a new foundation and siding. He also built the silos. It has been a dairy barn all of its life and has only had dairy cattle in it. The barn has been kept up even though there isn't any livestock in it now, not even a cat, said Deanna. The barn received a fresh coat of paint this past summer. Window boxes with flowers are placed under each window every summer. The barn interior has most of the dairy equipment in it, including the barn cleaner. It looks as if the dairy cattle will return someday. The silo unloaders are still in the silos. There is straw in the overhead mow. Russ has retired from farming and rents the land to another farmer. Deanna taught business courses at the high school level, and while retired, she works as a substitute teacher when asked. Having been raised on a dairy farm, plus Russ milked cows most of his farming career, the brother and sister continue with the work ethic they learned from their years with dairy cattle. We've always had cattle, said Deanna. Their daily routine is built around the daily routine they learned while growing up, such as three meals a day and working outside. We've never gotten out of that routine, said Deanna, of the daily schedule of a dairy farm. She keeps up a large garden through the summer, growing potatoes, peas, onions, carrots, Brussels sprouts, watermelons, cantaloupe, kohlrabi, flowers, and more. I don't hardly buy vegetables, she said. Even in retirement, the Richters appreciate their life on the farm. It's a pretty good life, said Deanna. We have pretty good tenants in that barn, said Russ. If you took good care of them, they took good care of you. The Richter's dairy cattle milk production placed them in the top 10% of the state. When asked what will become of the barn when they will not be able to take care of it, Deanna answered, "That's got us worried. They are hoping that possibly a great-nephew will assume the farming and caretaking of the barn." A reminder, the alley behind the Fort Dodge Municipal Building will be closed on weekdays beginning Wednesday, continuing through the end of May. The alley will be closed from 7 a.m. to 3:30 p.m. due to renovations at the municipal building. Remembering Rudy is the title of the next article. Going to town with Grandpa to visit the local friendly tavern is something Kendall Kale has fond memories of as a child. K Cale grew up on a farm outside of Farnhamville, and getting to observe his grandpa's interactions with the locals was quite a thrill. He always came to town every day to the friendly tavern at noon and at 5 o'clock for a beer, Cale recalled of his grandpa, and sometimes he would take me with him. Cale was born deaf, and although he couldn't hear the conversations happening around him, he enjoyed seeing his grandpa make connections with others, and of course he made some too. I remember grandpa talking to everyone, he said. He described his grandpa as a foodie. He was not afraid to try anything. He was always willing to try new things. So when Cale opened his restaurant in Farnhamville in March, the name that customers saw on the sign outside of the building was Rudy's. Cale's grandpa was named Rudolph, a.k.a. Rudy. He passed away in 1996. The lettering on the sign is his grandpa's actual signature. Although the restaurant bears Rudy's name, it was another grandparent that inspired Cale to cook in the first place, his grandmother, Olga Hansen. Cale started his educational journey in Fort Dodge at a special program for the deaf. Later, he attended the Iowa School for the Deaf from grades 5 through 10. He graduated from Prairie Valley High School in 1991. In the years that followed, Cale held a number of odd jobs, including owning a t-shirt company, but none of those jobs felt like his true calling. At one point in his life, he wondered what he should do, said Cale's mother, Rita, who translates for him. His grandma encouraged him to cook. She knew he liked to cook. Hansen herself was a school cook for 19 years for Cedar Valley Community Schools before it merged with Prairie Gallery in 1993 to form Prairie Valley. Cale graduated from Le Cordon Bleu College of Culinary Arts in Minneapolis-St. Paul in 2011. His grandmother died in 2012. In going through school, he worked with other really great chefs and had to prove he could do it. They are very strict, and that's how they gain their skills. Cale landed one of his first jobs at Ward 6 in St. Paul in 2013. Later, he was chef at Bar Brigade in St. Paul. He was the only deaf chef in St. Paul, Rita said. But when the COVID-19 pandemic hit in 2020, many bars and restaurants closed down. The Bar Brigade was one of them. Because of COVID, 65% of restaurants and bars in the St. Paul area closed, Cale said. With the sudden loss of income, Cale decided it was time to move back home. He arrived back in Farnhamville in July 2020. By the spring, he was ready to open Rudy's and share his culinary skills with his hometown. The restaurant is located at 230 Garfield Avenue. The building is owned by Farnhamville's Betterment Building Committee. People are following him. They've heard about his skills, said Rita. They know he brings different things and are willing to try them. Rudy's is the only restaurant in town of less than 500 people, which Cale sees as a challenge. Small town, no competition, he said. Competition is good for every business. Learning what people like around here is different than in the city. Getting people to try new things. Ribeye steak, Rudy's bone-in pork chop, and Rudy's pub burger are some of the most popular items on the menu. The Rudy's burger is a 6-ounce burger with American cheese, bacon, caramelized onions, Dijonnaise, and pickles. The pork chop is smoked and grilled with apple demi-glace. A variety of salads, sandwiches, and pizzas are served. Rudy's also has a full bar with multiple beers on tap. Cale said he likes to change the menu throughout the year to match seasonal tastes. Being creative and being able to make new things is what he loves about being a chef. Cale orders his beef from a farm in Wisconsin that he became familiar with from his past work. He orders the meat, and it's flown in from Wisconsin, Rita said. He would visit the farm so he knows how they are raised in the quality of the meat, and that's very important for him, so he cuts his ribeyes and cuts his own pork chops. The restaurant employs about 10 part-time workers. Rita helps where needed. I am his ears, she said. I mingle amongst the customers and share with him what people are saying. In July, Cale plans to meet with his high school graduating class at Rudy's for their reunion. Rudy's is open Wednesday through Saturday from 4 p.m. to 10 p.m. The kitchen opens at 5 o'clock. When Neil Beringham said the grass is greener where you water it, he might not have been referring to lawn care, but if he was, he wasn't wrong. Now is the time to be giving your lawn some attention in order to give it the best start it can in hopes for a healthy turf all season long. The healthier you have your turf, the less susceptible it is for weeds, diseases, or other things like that to move in, said Scott Birdsell, turf grass management coordinator at Iowa Central Community College in Fort Dodge. The warm weather we had the latter part of March and early April gave the grass a head start, but with the recent cool weather, in many cases dropping down to freezing at night, has slowed the growth of grass down some. Is it too cold to be tending to your lawn? Birdsell said it appears the grass isn't under too much stress at this time. However, some areas might be showing some yellowing due to the color or the cooler nighttime temperatures, but it is still okay to go out and start working with your yard. One of the first steps to a healthy lawn in the spring, Birdsell said, is to get out and clean up your yard by removing any twigs and debris. Get it cleaned up, get the sticks, leaves, rocks, and other debris out of the way so the grass has the best chance to get growing, he said. An application of spring fertilizer is a good way to get the grass growing nice and green. According to Adam Toms, assistant professor in horticulture and turf grass extension for Iowa State Extension and Outreach, typically an application of 3/4 of a pound per 1,000 square feet of nitrogen using a slow-release fertilizer is helpful for turf in the springtime. The slow release will help avoid burning and other injuries to the lawn. Birdsell said fertilizer combination higher in nitrogen is recommended. It promotes growth. You get that dark green color. If you are putting nitrogen down, you are going to be mowing quite a bit more, but it is nice to give you that nice thick lawn. Keep in mind, however, more is not better. Put it down according to rates on the label. Don't just put a whole bunch on. That is not healthy for your turf. Technically, Birdsell said the best time to seed is in the late summer or early fall when there is less competition for weeds. However, it is still okay to seed in the spring. If you're going to reseed, do it now when it's cooler, he said. If you reseed in the summertime, you're dealing with heat, and you're going to have to put a lot more water on it than you do now. New growth may also need a boost with some starter fertilizer. In this case, you are wanting phosphorus, he said. It promotes root growth and development, and that is what you want for new seeding. Tom said due to the drought from last fall, any seeding done that may need redone this spring, as the fall drought may have dried out the seedlings. Also, Tom's added, if you are seeding this spring, avoid applying a crabgrass preventer. Although effective at preventing crabgrass, this product will also keep the regular grass seed from germinating. Regarding pesticides, springtime is also an opportunity to apply any herbicides that may not have been applied last fall. Later April, 1st of May would be a nice time for those applications, Birdsell said. Get the turf up and growing good, and you can spray it. Birdsell advises following the label or contacting a professional for assistance. A later season insecticide may be needed as well. In one instance, Birdsell said they applied insecticide later June to the first part of July to help in the control of grubs. Regarding water, Birdsell said when it comes to watering your lawn, he prefers a deep watering. Said this is because what this is going to do is promote the root system to go down. With short watering periods, the roots will stay at the top, and you won't have a good root system when it becomes stressed in the heat. Just be sure to not keep your grass continuously soaked in water. When that happens, root diseases and other issues could occur. Once you get your turf established, you want to be careful when it comes to mowing. I follow the 1/3 rule, he said. If you mow your yard at 2 inches, wait until it gets up to 3 inches and cut it down to 2 inches and no more. It is not good for the grass. You are susceptible to scalping it. Proper blade maintenance is also important for lawn care. Make sure your blades are sharp. If you have dull blades, you will tear the grass instead of cutting it. Once you tear it on the top, it will turn brown, and then your grass becomes susceptible to diseases and other issues. Birdsell said this is the 14th year Iowa Central has offered the turf grass management program. There are 3 options for the program that is typically attended by 8 to 10 students each year. The 1-year program, Birdsell said, is made up of a fall and spring semester, class time in the summer, and an internship. Students then earn a turf grass technician diploma. There is a 2-year course as well as a transfer option after 2 years. Graduates of the program, Birdsell said, have gone to work throughout the country. The best part of my job is seeing what the kids do and where they go, he said. We've had 3 kids do their internship at Fenway Park for the Boston Red Sox, the Padres, and one was working for the Houston Astros, who even has a World Series ring. A large draw to Iowa Central's turf management program is the fact that the college has its own golf course. There are only 3 colleges in Iowa that have their own golf courses: the University of Iowa, Iowa State, and Iowa Central Community College. We've got this 60-acre area that is our outdoor classroom. The students get tons of hands-on experience. We work on equipment, irrigation, landscaping, all over the golf course. It's nice we are out here. We can go out to the golf course. Just a reminder, Webster County Conservation will hold a fireside chat from 6 to 8 p.m. Thursday at Camp Winoki. The camp is located 1 mile east of Colville and 1/2 mile south on Winoki Camp Road. You're encouraged to bring a comfy campfire chair and relax around a campfire, get a trail map, and head out on the trails in search of smile rocks to collect. Get a GPS unit and search the camp and woodlands for geocaches hidden for seekers. Comfortable shoes for hiking are recommended. For more information, call 576-4258. Help is on the way is the next article. It's from the Webster City Daily Freeman Journal. Officials with the Hamilton County Child Care Coalition say they have nearly completed the first round of fundraising for the group's retention and hiring bonus program. McKinley Bailey, a building family, said the coalition has met with a group of Hamilton County's largest employers to present the bonus program. These businesses from around the county have pledged so far just over $100,000, he said, adding that businesses have pledged that amount for the next 3 years. The first retention bonus checks are going out this month, he said, to full-time workers who achieve the program's criteria. If we can get to our goal of $150,000 pledged for each year, then we could pay bonuses to the part-time workers. The part-time workers are a big piece of the child care workforce. We don't want to overlook them. He said he hoped to have data on the effectiveness of the bonus program in July, as the daycare centers will submit reports with details on what employee turnover looks like in the 6 months before the program started and what it looks like now. We'll track that over the next 3.5 years so that if data works, we'll have the data to show employers that this is a worthwhile investment, he said. Bailey said he believes that employers are recognizing the importance of child care to their workforces. They figured out that this is impacting their bottom line, and I think that's why they are responding, he said. He said he heard from multiple employers who told of offering a job to someone only to have the candidate turn down the job because they couldn't find child care. Then there are employees who have to call in because there's not a steady supply of child care. The employers see that in the absenteeism. Bailey said the program now has been rolled out to the smaller and medium-sized employers in the county. We're asking employers who can tell this is impacting their ability to grow their businesses to contribute to enhance Hamilton County Foundation funds, he said. Last week, the Enhanced Hamilton County Foundation announced a fund was open to accept donations to support child care services throughout Hamilton County. According to the foundation, the Hamilton County Child Care Initiative Fund will initially support the recruitment and retainment bonus program being established by the Hamilton County Child Care Coalition, along with building families to assist child care centers with attracting and retaining employees. Donations to the Hamilton County Child Care Initiative Fund can be made by check or online through the foundation's website at enhancehamiltoncounty.org. Donors can mail a check noting the name of the fund to Enhance Hamilton County Foundation, 501 Bank Street, Webster City, Iowa, 50595. For information on donating to the Hamilton County Child Care Initiative Fund, contact Darcy Sloan by calling 515-835-0437. Bailey's message to those families looking for child care resources: help is on the way, he said. It's a solvable problem. We have lots of space open. We just don't have enough workers to operate at full capacity. He said Blairsburg's Mighty Trojan Daycare is operating at 35% of licensed capacity. Webster City Daycare is at 60% of capacity. Stratford Early Childhood Center is at 60% capacity. Riverview Early Child Care Center is doing a little better. They are close to 80% capacity, but there are over 100 unused spaces right now in Hamilton County. Bailey said the heart of the problem is the centers have trouble hiring anyone based on wages of $8.50 per hour. You know, a lot of times people will say, well, why not just raise the rates? The ability of families to pay more is really limited, according to Bailey. Infant care in Hamilton County centers is almost the same as the cost of tuition and fees at the University of Northern Iowa for a year, he said. Last year, UNI was about $500 more expensive than infant care in Hamilton County. Of course, students attending college can get scholarships, Pell Grants, or student loans. There's nothing like that out there for working families seeking child care, he said. The City Council Webster City Review, an updated plan for Fuller Hall hours, will discuss a possible cleanup drop-off day this summer, Monday night, during its regular season session meeting. The meeting will be held virtually. The council will also hold a public hearing on the 2020 sewer rehabilitation and repair project and will consider plans and specifications and proposed form of contract for the project, which will consist of storm sewer outlet repairs on East Dubuque Street and sanitary sewer repairs on Lincoln Drive, Apple Avenue, Cedar Street, and Superior Street. The bid letting for the project was held April 8th. Three bids were received, with the lowest bid coming in from Nels Pedersen Company, Incorporated, a Badger, in the amount of $170,095. The council will also hold the second reading of a proposed ordinance which would add stop signs at Commerce Drive at Close Drive and North Terrace Drive at Fair Meadow Drive. According to project coordinator Matt Alcazar, requests from residents on the proposed stop signs were brought to the traffic committee. The council will also award a contract for a concrete crushing project to Mobile Crushing and Recycling of Otho in the amount of $202,500. According to a memo to the council, 13,000 tons of sub-base material is needed for the second street project. The street project has a pile with 10,000 tons of concrete. An additional 6,397 tons will be removed from 2nd Street during the project. The plan is to crush the used concrete to be used as subgrade rock material for the project. A resolution accepting the work and authorizing the final estimate with the final retainage in the amount of $66,000+ to Jensen Builders Limited, Fort Dodge, for the completion of the street department maintenance building is expected to be approved. The council will also consider a resolution entering into Amendment 10, Number 10A on the on-call street paving specialist agreement from February 6, 2017 with Snyder & Associates Incorporated with the 2021 2nd Street Reconstruction Project in the amount of $110,300. A second resolution approving Amendment Number 16 to the On-Call Street Paving Specialist Agreement with Snyder & Associates for the completion of the 2021 HMA Street Improvement Project is also on the agenda. The project involves street improvements to Betsy Lane from Beach Street to Sunset Drive, Seneca Street from Pleasant Street to Bank Street, Betsy Lane water main replacement, and parking lot reconstruction at the 400 block of First Street, also known as City Hall Parking Lot. The City Council will also set a public hearing on an application for voluntary annexation located west of the corporate limits of Webster City. Information service for the blind. And now we will turn to the Messenger obituary page. Doris Rollo, 88, of Davenport, died Saturday, April 17th. At Bickford Cottages, services are pending at Lapisweiler Funeral Home. And that is all that there is for today's obituary page. Members of the Webster City Parks and Rec Commission heard an update on the city parks projects and learned more about what Phase 2 of the East Twin Park revitalization could look like. The commission met via Zoom this past Thursday night. Recreation and Public Grounds Director Larry Flaw said Habhab Construction had won the bid for the concrete and plumbing work at the West Twin Park shelter and had already been in the park working on the project. Flaw added that the groundwork was finished at East Twin Park and the new playground and fitness equipment are just waiting for the pour of rubber mat to be installed. He said the company doing the work have rescheduled the procedure due to cold temperatures, but are planning to do the work April 22nd if possible. The temperatures have to be above 40 degrees for them to pour rubber, he said. Murray Fortune, who has been an active voice in the East Wind Park revitalization project, talked to the commission about the next phase of improvements. She told the commission members that preliminary plans she's discussed with flaws include removing the existing brick shelter building and replacing it with an open shell-style structure with restrooms and a storage area. Flaws suggested placing a smaller but similar shelter to what will soon be erected in West Twin Park. He said he would get cost comparisons for the commission members. Fortune said she plans to fundraise for the project as the city has no additional funds budgeted for the park. She added that she would like to see a cement pad that could be used for outdoor fitness classes. Flaws said that with the pad in place, it could be set up for other activities, such as pickleball, when not in use for fitness classes. Janet Adams and Mark Domes, representing the Arts Are Alive Committee, spoke to the commission members about a plan to create a memorial tribute for the late Kent Harfst, longtime director of recreation and public grounds. Harfst died in a cycling accident in September 2019. What we are thinking about is some kind of public art piece for Kent. We've been looking at a location at Hospital Hill, Janet Adams said. Adams said the piece would be located near the sidewalk on Des Moines Street near the crest of the hill. It would be some sort of sculpture piece or mediation area, she said. The committee has sent out requests for proposals to about 15 artists. The deadline to receive responses from the artists is June 10th. We've done some fundraising and are off to a pretty good start with that, she said. Adams explained that the piece would likely cost between $10,000 to $12,000. The commission members voted in support of the proposed project. Adams said the city told her that after the Parks Commission, the matter would need to go to the Planning and Zoning Commission and ultimately to the City Council for approval. Flaws also told the commission that the opening date for the outdoor swimming pool will be Saturday, June 5th. He added that the pool would tentatively close on August 22nd for the season. He also provided an update on the spring hours for Fuller Hall. The facility would be open beginning April 26th from 6 a.m. to 9 p.m. Monday through Thursday, Friday 6 a.m. to 10 p.m., Saturday 7 a.m. to 10 p.m., Sunday 1 p.m. to 9 p.m. Lap swimming would be available weekdays from 6 to 8, 11 to 1, and 5 to 7, and Saturdays from 7 to 9 and 11 to 1 p.m. Open swimming would be available Monday, Wednesday, Friday nights from 7 to 9, Saturdays 2 to 4 and 7 to 9. Swimming would be limited to 20 swimmers at one time. Other restrictions would still be in place. No parties or birthday parties, classes, or group meetings would be allowed. The game room would be open at 2:10 at a time, as would the TV room. The gym would continue to be open to 20 individuals at one time for free shooting only. Racquetball courts would continue to be open for just racquetball and no volleyball at this time. Van Diest Medical Center is partnering with 21st Century Rehab to offer a therapy and Parkinson's workshop. The public is invited to join this free virtual event to be held via Facebook Live on Tuesday, April 20th from 5 to 6 p.m. Presenters will include occupational therapist Diana Raska, physical therapist Lori Andrews, and speech therapist Kelsey Fett, who will be speaking about how rehabilitative therapy can improve daily living activities, balance walking, and communication skills for those suffering from Parkinson's disease. There will also be limited in-person seating available for those wishing to attend the workshop, which will be held in the cafeteria conference room at the hospital. Community members of all ages are invited to join the free presentation virtually by liking the Van Diest Medical Center Facebook page. Those interested in attending in person may register by calling Van Diest Medical Center Physical Therapy Department at 832-7735. Ashley Allers, Director of Revenue Cycle and Integrity Compliance and Privacy Officer at Van Diest Medical Center, has been selected to sit on the National Association of Healthcare Revenue Integrity Advisory Board. The NARI Advisory Board is composed of a group of healthcare revenue professionals whose mission is to enhance revenue integrity through standards, advocacy, networking, and the promotion of shared knowledge and resources. The board is made up of professionals from all over the country who bring a wide range of experience and expertise to the healthcare revenue integrity field. Allers brings nearly 10 years of healthcare experience in management, revenue cycle, charge master, and Cerner Electronic Health Record, or known as EHR, implementation to the board. She has obtained her Certified Revenue Cycle Executive, Certified Revenue Cycle Specialist, Certified Revenue Integrity Professional, certifications from the American Association of Healthcare Administrative Management, and her Certified Revenue Cycle Representative certification through Healthcare Financial Management Association. Allers joined Van Deest Medical Center in 2012 as Business Office Manager with oversight of the Business Office and Patient Access Departments. Since that time, she was named Director of Revenue Cycle in 2016, adding direct oversight of the Health Information Management Department. In July 2019, Allers also assumed the Integrity, Compliance, and Privacy Office. We'll look next at a column, entitled Rural Hospitals for Vital Care Providers and Economic Engines. And this is submitted by Jason Harrington, who is chair of the Iowa Hospital Association. The nearly 1 in 5 Americans who live in rural areas rely on local hospitals and health systems as a critical and often the only source of care in their communities. But rural hospitals are more than just care sites. They serve a vital role for regional economies. Jobs generated by rural hospitals support the tax base that funds public education, fire and police services, and road maintenance. Nearly 60 million rural Americans depend on their hospitals as an important source of care as well as a critical component of their area's economic and social fabric. Unfortunately, too many rural hospitals struggle to keep their doors open. A recent report from the Center for Healthcare Quality found more than 500 rural hospitals at risk of closure even before the public health emergency, including 40 rural hospitals in Iowa. Low patient volumes, sicker patient populations, geographic isolation, shifts in care delivery, increased regulatory burden, and the opioid crisis contribute to these bleak statistics. The pandemic has hastened these trends. Recent forecasts project total hospital revenue in 2021 could drop by up to $122 billion from pre-pandemic levels. This sustained reduction in hospital resources could slow down vaccine distribution and administration, continue pressure on caregivers, and diminish access to care in rural communities. We must do everything we can to ensure rural hospitals have needed resources and payment flexibility to avoid cash flow challenges that could force them to close. A promising payment tool is the Rural Community Hospital Demonstration Model, championed by Senator Chuck Grassley. Designed with rural hospitals in mind, the model targets facilities lacking economies of scale because of their size, but may be too large to qualify for programs to help the smallest hospitals. The model pilots reimbursement based on the cost for providing services in rural hospitals that have fewer than 51 beds and provide 24-hour emergency care services. At Lakes Regional Hospital Healthcare in Spirit Lake, we already know this essential help for rural community works. We are a rural hospital with about 60% Medicare patients. During a typical year, we incur losses with our Medicare patients of approximately $4 to $5 million. This has a great impact on a bottom line that without the model runs close to break even. Of the Medicare patient revenue generated, 25% is for inpatient care. To be reimbursed at a higher level that covers the hospital costs for inpatient care, through the model allows us to generate a modest net income. This net income provides new equipment and expansion in service lines for the area's growing Medicare population. Without the model, the long-term viability of Lakes Regional Healthcare and other similar hospitals would be in jeopardy. A 2018 report to Congress from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services found the partnership financial benefits of participating in the model saved many facilities from having to alter or downsize their operations, improved cash and financial security, and facilitated the continued support of their local economies. The report also shows that the model provided high-quality health care, so patients don't have to sacrifice quality to stay at their local hospitals. Senator Grassley just led the successful effort to extend this important program for another 5 years. Now we can build on the promising results we have seen so far, supporting patient access to care and helping keep our doors open when it is so sorely needed. Rural hospitals and health systems have been on the front lines of the COVID-19 pandemic, working to provide quality care for our patients, families, and communities. Despite unprecedented financial and health care challenges, rural hospitals remain committed to ensuring local access to high-quality, affordable health care during the pandemic and beyond. Thanks to Senator Grassley's leadership in maintaining the Rural Community Hospital Program, Lakes Regional Healthcare and other community hospitals nationwide will continue serving as community anchors and lifelines of care. And that is submitted by Jason Harrington, who is the president and CEO of Lakes Regional Healthcare in Spirit Lake. He is also the chair of the Iowa Hospital Association's Board of Officers and Trustees. Speaking of rural health care, first responder shortage is extreme in Marshall County. This is an article from the Marshalltown Times-Republican. The number of volunteer emergency responders is dwindling nationwide, and Marshall County is seeing the same problem. Emergency Management Coordinator Kim Elder has noticed a downturn in volunteerism during the last 10 years. An upswing does not appear to be imminent. It's extreme, Elder said of the shortage. It gets worse every year. The severity of the situation varies from town to town. Haverhill and Laurel have lost departments, and Clemens EMS has fallen to the wayside without volunteers. The result is longer response times as out-of-town agencies need to cover those communities. Meanwhile, the departments in places such as State Center and Marshalltown need to stretch their resources even further. State Center picked up the Clemens area and covers to the county line. That's a huge response area. Liscombe is very short. Ferguson has not had EMS for many years. The problem is even more prevalent during the daytime when most volunteers are working. This issue is even more evident when there are late-night calls like the recent field fires near Albion. Elder said some of the firefighters left from the call early in the morning after battling the fire, only to turn around and go to work directly after. They are going nonstop. Many of them do that. You can only do that so much to a human before they burn out. The state of volunteer EMS departments across Iowa is similar to what the rest of the United States is seeing, according to Elder. Elder attributes the shrinking number of volunteers to several causes. Some volunteer first responders experience the burnout, Elder mentioned. While the older firefighters and EMS responders are leaving, there aren't enough younger volunteers replacing them. This could be because of an increased focus on work. Many people work more than one job. Others may not be exposed to or educated on the ways they can help. The EMS coordinator hopes to incorporate more education and awareness, especially to junior high and high school-aged children. She said she has spoken with state senators and representatives and brings the issue up with governor's office regularly. I really would like to see some programs put into junior high and high school. Doing some job shadowing, Elder said, if we can put them through EMT or firefighter classes, that would be amazing. So we'd be coming out of the school with kids very excited to put those skills to work and bring them back to the community. For people who aren't fully trained to be an EMT or a firefighter but still want to help, there is a need for community emergency response team volunteers, known as CERT. They fill the gap between the untrained citizen and the first responder. They might supplement some help on a big accident and do things a trained person doesn't need to be doing, like traffic control. The loss of volunteers and the culture of volunteerism isn't only noticed by Elder in EMS. Elder has noticed many community organizations and churches are often strapped for volunteers as well. Some things have changed about how people look at volunteerism, she said. It's not that people don't want to give back. People are burning the candle at both ends and they're very busy. The more we can, as first responders and public agencies, teach people how important it is, plant that seed and they'll get the bug. It becomes like a big family. Once people get involved and if they don't get burned out, I think they really do what they really do enjoy what they do. If you have questions about volunteering as a first responder, taking a class, or just want to get involved, you may contact Marshall County Emergency Management Coordinator Kim Elder at 641-751-1726. Buying a home, act now, is the headline. Again, from the Marshalltown Times-Republican, buying a home in Marshalltown is tough. Demand is no higher than it was a year ago, but the supply is exceedingly low. The market is something new Horizons realtor Jeff Hayden has not seen in his 28-year career. Many of the listings he gets are only on the market for 1 or 2 days, then they are sold. Interest rates are so low, a lot of people are realizing that they can own their own house for not much more than what they pay in rent every month, he said. While that might be enough to make some people consider selling, Hayden said potential sellers also need to find a home. They are not about to sell without making sure they have another home waiting, and there are not a lot of homes ready to be purchased. The lack of homes extends beyond Marshalltown. Hayden said it is a nationwide issue, and many cities and towns have less than one-third of normal housing inventory. It is scary because a lot of people need to move for jobs or are ready to retire. Premier real estate agent Chris Broden said it is remarkable if a Marshalltown home manages to stay on the market for more than one day. During the first 24 hours, multiple showings are held, offers made, and a sale finalized. On average, it sells the first day, and I have anywhere from 7 to 15 showings within that one day, he said. Some of the offers exceed whatever the asking price might be. The highest Broden has seen his go is $20,000 more than the asking price. The age-old advice of making an offer less than the asking price is not valid right now. Those are not successful, he said. Other buyers are trying to sweeten the deal by foregoing home inspections or warranties. Using local lenders is a big tip, Broden said, people need to use when trying to successfully navigate this market. Everyone wants to work with people they know, so find a local lender, he said. Hayden suggests buyers keep an eye on the website Realtor.com. All the local offices are on there, along with new listings and pending sales. If you have a favorite realtor, ask him or her to watch the website for you. Broden and Hayden stress the importance of having a pre-approval letter before even trying to buy. You need to have that pre-approval letter in hand or you are not even competing, he said. Buyers are trying to make the sale clean. Just remember, cash is king. How long will this market last? Hayden believes it will change after more people get the COVID-19 vaccine. I've had people tell me they want to sell, but they want to wait to show until more people get those shots, which will make them more comfortable with listing, he said. Then those sellers will be more willing to let strangers into their homes. As it is becoming easier to get vaccines, this market does not leave room for decision-making or time to contemplate. Broden said it is imperative for people to take immediate action. When the sign is up, call your agent and get in to see it that day, he said. Maybe bring a family member or friend along with you who can point out some things or ask questions. Because if you want to compete right now, you might not want a home inspection. You have to make a quick decision. Tomorrow is going to be too late. Heading over to the Messenger Sports section, Feeling Blue as Area Athletes Get Ready for Drake Relays is the title of the article. Many of the top athletes from around the area will get their chance to compete on the Blue Oval during the upcoming 111th Drake Relays. The event, which was canceled last year due to the pandemic, begins on Wednesday, continuing through Saturday afternoon. For Dodgers, Tyler Schreier is one of five area athletes set to compete in two events as the Dodgers senior runs the 100-meter dash and is in the long jump. Southeast Valley's Kirsten Fisher has qualified in both the high jump and 100 hurdles. Humboldt's Quentin Orr, 3,200 and 1,600, Kendall Clark in the discus and shot putt, and Webster City's J.J. Moore in the discus and shot putt are also entered into two events. Clark comes into Drake second in the discus and third in the shot putt, while Orr is ranked third in the 3,200 and fourth in the 1,600. The Dodger boys advanced their 4x1, 4x2, and 4x400 relays. Christian Davidson, Jake Erickson, Sam Daniel, and Schreier make up the 4x1 and 4x2, with Erickson, Jerry Chatta, James Daniel, and Eli Elsbecker the 4x4. Fort Dodge's 4x1 relay has recorded the third fastest time of the year. Southeast Valley's Caleb Scott in the high jump, Pocahontas Area's Trey Olertz in the 100, and Dane Johnson shot putt. Humboldt's Caden Mattson in the 110 hurdles. Green County's Jackson Morton in the 110 hurdles. Bryce Stalder in the long jump and Nathan Black in the high jump also advanced. Olertz is 6th in the state in the 100, and Moore is 4th in the shot putt. Vance of Northwest Webster's Cale Collins is advanced in the 110 hurdles. Humboldt will also compete in the distance medley and shuttle hurdle relays, with Green County qualifying in the shuttle hurdle relay. For girls, Manson Northwest Webster's Jeannie Weiss and Lexi Wood earned spots. Weiss will be in the high jump and Wood the shot putt. Bishop Garrigan's Audie Crooks in the shot putt. West Bend Mallard's Rachel Fear in the 400. North Union's Samantha Nielsen in the high jump. and Greene County's Brooklyn Olsen in the shot put are also entered. Crux is 4th in the state in the shot put and Fear 11th in the 400. Weiss and Fisher are both tied for 6th in the high jump. With attendance limited this season, 8 hours of high school competition will air live on Thursday via Mediacom Channel MC22 and broadcast with a live stream on runnerspace.com. Playing for the first time away from Dodger Stadium, the 9th-ranked Iowa Central football team had no trouble with Ellsworth winning Saturday in Iowa Falls by a score of 58-6. Major Williams set the tone early, returning the opening kickoff back 74 yards for a touchdown for the Tritons, who now prepare for a rematch with number 5 Iowa Western in Council Bluffs next weekend. The Rivers downed Arkansas Baptist 45-0. Brady Pope completed 9 of 17 passes for 120 yards and 3 touchdowns, while Byron Jarrett accounted for over 150 yards of offense and 3 passing touchdowns in his return against the Panthers. Jarrett spent his freshman season with Ellsworth. It was great playing there again, especially seeing some familiar faces of guys I played with on the Ellsworth staff. It felt great to have a great traveling crowd for the support as well. Jarrett completed 8 of 14 for 77 yards, adding an 87 yards on the ground. Jaden Washington ran for 70 yards while at the touchdown, while Clayton Allendike had 6 receptions for 75 yards and caught 3 scores. Chase Levy also had a touchdown reception on the day, with Colin Swagman making a 27-yard field goal. Ellsworth's lone points came in the third on a Jaron early touchdown run. Earlier this year, Iowa Central suffered a 34-20 setback to Iowa Western. When G. Myers became the Fort Dodge girls soccer coach, she knew exactly how she wanted to start. From the beginning, Myers, who played soccer at Iowa Central and Grandview, stressed the fundamentals from day one. "It's been a little bit of an adjustment because I have a different style," Myers said. "I want to find each player's strength and go with that so we can be more successful. A lot of coaches put them where they want them to be. One of my favorite coaches found what I was good at and put me at that position while we worked on things that I wasn't as strong at. I love fundamentals. It was kind of slow starting because I was doing simple drills, nothing too big." Now, 1 month into the season, Myers finally saw everything come together this past Thursday when the girls had a scrimmage against the Dodger Boys Junior Varsity squad. "We had a scrimmage against the boys, and that was the first time that girls all going together in one direction," Myers said. "At practice, we would break up and work on things on offense and defense. Until that scrimmage, they didn't visualize what was happening. In that scrimmage, I saw the most energy out of the girls, and they finally put it all together. It was a light bulb moment for the girls. Maybe Coach knows what she is doing." Myers has coached at lower levels before the Fort Dodge Soccer Association and some traveling teams. Myers was originally going to be an assistant with the Dodger program, but the head coaching spot became available, and she decided to give it a go. "I started working at the high school after being at the elementary level," said Myers, who is a student success specialist at senior high. "I didn't realize how low the numbers were at the high school level and how much of a struggle it was to get coaches." Ryan O'Leary, the assistant athletic and activities director, who I coached when he was younger, asked me to apply for the job. "I was hesitant at first, but ultimately I knew it was something I was ready for." Myers knows the job won't be easy, especially given the schedule Fort Dodge faces. "We're definitely rebuilding, but we have to trust in the process. We all have been through some struggles, but we are in the process of learning the game and seeing where it takes us. The first part of learning is to know that the offensive starts from the defensive end." That was something that some of the girls shared. They didn't realize that even if you're on defense, you're on offense. They just have to trust each other. Myers will be leaning on junior Aja Jallo and St. Edmund freshman Sylvia Heldorfer in the midfield. "Aja has such a strong presence and is definitely a person you look at out there. Sylvia is the smaller version of Aja. She kicks with both feet and has great vision. We just need to get the freshman out of her and get her to become a leader. They are trusting the process. They were typically defensive players, but we are going to put them at midfield. They are strong and understand the defense so they can play the ball. We want them in the heart of the field." Other key players for senior high will be St. Edmund's seniors Leah Johnson and Kelly Kirsten. "We will lean on Leah and Kelly on the outside. Those two demand a lot of presence. They will spread the field out and be pushing the ball in the offensive half." The Dodgers will open the season on Tuesday at Johnston, beginning at 6 o'clock. We know we are going to be going up against tough competition, Meyer said. We just have to trust in the system, work on the fundamentals to become better players and students of the game. Time is fleeing, so let's take a quick look at the forecast for the next 7 days. I thought I saw temperatures in the 70s coming up, so hopefully we'll find that in our forecast. Tuesday, we'll see a high of 44, low of 26. Wednesday, high of 49, low of 28. Thursday, mostly clear, high of 59, low of 41, with a chance of rain showers. Friday, cloudy, high of 59, low of 38. Saturday, high of 57, low of 35. Sunday, high of 61, low of 45. Monday, mostly cloudy, but we're looking at a temperature of 71 degrees. So just a slight chance of rain, possibly, what, on Thursday, I think I saw? Yep. Anyhow, that's going to bring us to the end of the reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger for Monday, April 19th. I'm Kevin Rogers. Thank you so much for joining me for this time together. Of course, we appreciate your support at IRIS, Iowa Radio Information Service for the Blind. And these podcasts are available to you at iowaradioreading.org. Stay safe, stay healthy, take good care of yourselves, and we'll talk to you again real soon here on IRIS. Bye-bye for now.